Rain battered the stained glass, casting bruised shadows across the damp stone altar. Margot stood rigid in heavy white silk that smelled faintly of camphor and desperation. Beside her stood a man 22 years her senior, his face a landscape of hard lines and old weather. This wasn't romance, it was a transaction. A bankrupt father's debt erased by a duke's heavy purse. She braced for a tyrant's cruelty. What she didn't expect, what truly undid her, was his quiet, devastating kindness. The church smelled of wet wool melting beeswax and the sharp metallic tang of her father's nervous sweat. Margot stared straight ahead. If she blinked, the tears pooling at the edges of her vision might fall, and she had promised herself she wouldn't give her father the satisfaction of seeing her break. Thomas Linfield's fingers dug into her arm, a bruising grip masquerading as paternal support. He was shaking. He had been shaking for 3 months, ever since the shipping venture collapsed, and the creditors began circling their London townhouse like starved dogs. Then came Desmond, Duke of Carlisle. He didn't arrive in a gilded carriage. He hadn't sent flowers. He had simply walked into her father's study wearing mud-splattered riding boots and a heavy wool coat that smelled of damp pine and paid the debts. In exchange, he required a wife. Someone young enough to bear an heir, but from a family desperate enough not to ask for a complicated courtship. Margot was 20. Desmond was 42. The math was a ledger entry simple and cold. Now standing at the altar, Margot finally looked at him. He was a large man, broad-shouldered and thick-chested, blocking out the meager light filtering through the apse. His hair was dark, heavily threaded with iron gray at the temples. His jaw was covered in a rough shadow of stubble, as if he hadn't bothered to summon a barber for his own wedding day. He stared at the vicar with an expression of mild, weary impatience. "I do," Desmond said. His voice was gravelly low and entirely devoid of inflection. He didn't look at her when he said it. When it was her turn, her throat closed. The silence in the stone church stretched, pulling taut. She felt her father's fingernails bite into the thin silk covering her bicep. "I do," she rasped. Desmond reached for her hand to slide the ring onto her finger. Margot flinched. It was a microscopic movement, a tiny jerk of her shoulder, but he felt it. His thick fingers paused. He looked down at her hand, small and trembling, in his massive, calloused palm. There was dirt beneath one of his fingernails. These were not the hands of a pampered aristocrat. They belonged to a man who pulled his own horses from the muck. He slid the heavy gold band over her knuckle. It was entirely too large. It hung loose on her pale finger, cold and heavy. He didn't squeeze her hand. He dropped it the moment the metal cleared her joint. The reception was a suffocating affair held in the echoing, drafty hall of her father's half-empty house. Most of the good furniture had already been sold. The guests were a sparse collection of gossiping aunts and Desmond's grim-faced business associates. Margot stood by a peeling radiator nursing a glass of warm, flat champagne. The corset beneath her dress was laced so tightly it pressed violently against her lower ribs. Every breath was a shallow, painful gasp. "Bought a broodmare, really," a voice murmured from behind a velvet curtain to her left. "Can't say I blame him. Carlisle needs sons, and Linfield needed to stay out of debtor's prison. Still, she looks entirely miserable." Margot swallowed the acidic champagne. She wasn't just miserable, she was furious. She was angry at her father for his reckless gambling, angry at the gossiping women, and fundamentally bitterly angry at the towering man standing across the room drinking whiskey in silence. Desmond caught her staring. Across the expanse of the room, through the haze of cigar smoke and stale perfume, his dark eyes locked onto hers. Margot didn't look away. She raised her chin, her jaw tight, projecting every ounce of her resentment into that single glare. Desmond stared back for a long moment. Then slowly he set his glass down. He didn't look angry. He looked profoundly exhausted. He crossed the room in long, heavy strides. The murmuring crowd parted for him instinctively. He stopped 2 feet from her close enough that she could smell the starch in his collar and the sharp scent of whiskey. "Go upstairs," he said, his voice a low rumble meant only for her. "Pack a small bag for the carriage. We leave in 20 minutes. The guests haven't eaten the cake, Your Grace. Margot said, her voice dripping with thin, icy politeness. I don't care about the cake, Desmond replied flatly. You look like you're about to faint, and I have an estate to run. 20 minutes, Margot. He turned and walked away before she could formulate a response. Margot stood there, clutching her glass, her knuckles white. He hadn't asked. He had ordered. The reality of her new life settled over her as heavy and suffocating as the dirt over a coffin. She was property now. The carriage was dark, smelling of worn leather horsehair and the bitter cold of a November evening. They had been driving north for 3 hours. The cobblestones of London had long since given way to the deeply rutted dirt roads of the countryside. Every jolt sent a shockwave up Margot's spine. She sat pressed against the far corner of the tufted leather bench, her knees drawn tightly together, a heavy wool blanket draped over her lap. Desmond sat opposite her. He hadn't spoken a single word since they left the city limits. He was leaning back, arms crossed over his broad chest, his eyes closed. His breathing was slow and even. She wondered if he was asleep or simply ignoring her. Margot's head pounded. The tight lacing of her corset combined with the sickening sway of the carriage and the utter lack of food in her stomach was creating a disastrous internal pressure. The flat champagne roiled in her gut. She swallowed hard-tasting bile. She stared out the window. The trees were black skeletal claws against a bruised purple twilight. The carriage hit a particularly deep pothole. The vehicle violently tipped. Margot gasped, throwing a hand over her mouth. Her stomach heaved violently. Desmond's eyes snapped open. He took one look at her pale, sweating face and slammed his fist against the wooden panel of the roof. "Halt!" he roared. The carriage lurched to a stop. Before the driver could even climb down, Desmond threw the door open. The biting winter wind rushed in. Margot didn't wait for him to offer a hand. She scrambled past him, practically falling out of the carriage. She hit the muddy roadside, falling to her hands and knees. The rough gravel bit into her palms. She retched into the tall, wet grass. It was utterly humiliating. On her wedding day, dressed in her silk and lace, she was on her hands and knees in the mud, vomiting violently into a ditch. She hacked and coughed, her body trembling with the sheer force of it. Tears of shame and physical exertion streamed down her cold cheeks. She expected a sneer. She expected him to express disgust at his new broken purchase. Footsteps crunched in the gravel behind her. A large, warm hand gathered her hair, pulling the heavy, pinned locks away from her face. The grip was firm, but surprisingly gentle. Margot froze, a dry heave racking her chest. "Let it out," Desmond said quietly. "You've been pale since the vicar started talking." She gagged again, spitting a bitter string of saliva into the grass. When she was finally empty, she sat back on her heels, shivering violently. Her breathing was ragged. She didn't look up at him. She couldn't. Desmond knelt beside her in the mud. He didn't seem to care that his expensive trousers were soaking up the dirty water. He held out a canteen. "Rinse," he instructed. She took it with shaking hands, rinsed her mouth, and spat. Then she took a small sip. The water was freezing and tasted faintly of tin, but it was the best thing she had ever swallowed. When she handed it back, he offered her a handkerchief. It wasn't monogrammed silk. It was a square of rough, clean linen. She wiped her mouth, smearing mud across her cheek in the process. "I'm sorry," she whispered, her voice cracking. Her cynicism was temporarily drowned by sheer mortification. "I ruined the dress." Desmond looked at the mud caked onto the hem of her white gown. "It's a terrible dress anyway," he said. There was no malice in his tone, just a blunt factual observation. "Looks entirely uncomfortable." He stood up and offered her his hand. Margot looked at it. It was thick, scarred, and steady. Slowly she placed her small, dirty hand in his. He hauled her up with effortless strength, pulling her out of the ditch. They climbed back into the carriage. As the horses resumed their trot, the silence returned, but the texture of it had changed. It was no longer suffocating, it was just quiet. They arrived at High Cross Estate just past midnight. Margot had expected a sprawling, symmetrical manor house with Greek columns and manicured lawns. Highcross was a massive, sprawling fortress of dark gray stone. It looked less like a home and more like a military outpost that had survived a siege. There were no decorative hedges. The outbuildings were utilitarian-smelling, strongly of wood smoke, wet hay, and livestock. As the carriage pulled into the courtyard, three massive wolfhounds came bounding out of the darkness, barking wildly. Desmond stepped down and whistled sharply. The hounds immediately ceased their barking and swarmed him, pushing their massive heads against his thighs. He scratched them behind the ears roughly before turning to help Margot down. A stout older woman stood in the heavy oak doorway holding a lantern. She wore a severe black dress and had a ring of keys at her waist. "Mrs. Hughes," Desmond said as he walked up the steps. "Take the bags. Have a fire lit in the east wing, the blue room."
"Yes, Your Grace,"
the housekeeper said, nodding curtly to Margot.
"Welcome, Your Grace."
Margot stepped into the entrance hall. It was drafty. The floorboards were bare, wide-planked oak scuffed by years of boots and dog claws. A single tapestry hung on the wall, its colors faded to a muddy brown. It was fiercely practical and entirely devoid of warmth. Desmond unbuttoned his heavy coat and threw it over a wooden bench. "Mrs. Hughes will show you to your room. There's hot water in the pitcher." Margot stopped. "My room." Desmond looked at her, his brow furrowing slightly. "Yes, the blue room. It has the best fireplace."
We are in separate rooms."
She hated how small her voice sounded. She had spent weeks agonizing over the wedding night, dreading the moment this massive older stranger would demand his marital rights. Now faced with a separate bedroom, she felt a bizarre, contradictory flash of rejection. Was she that repulsive? Was it the vomiting in the ditch? Desmond rubbed the bridge of his nose, suddenly looking every one of his 42 years. "Margot, you are 20 years old. You're exhausted, you're freezing, and you've just thrown up your own wedding toast. I'm going to my study to drink a glass of port and look at the grain ledgers. Go to sleep." He turned his back on her and walked down a dark corridor, two of the hounds following closely at his heels. Margot stood alone in the drafty hall, the silence ringing in her ears. A deep, profound relief washed over her, so intense it made her knees weak. Yet beneath the relief, a tiny spark of confusion ignited. He hadn't looked at her with pity. He hadn't looked at her with lust. He had looked at her like a person who simply needed a bed. The blue room was vast, dominated by a massive four-poster bed hung with heavy velvet curtains. The fireplace was roaring, though it smoked slightly, leaving a faint scent of charred cedar in the air. Margot had managed to unlace the agonizing corset by herself, twisting her arms painfully behind her back until the strings gave way. She had scrubbed the mud from her face and hands, using the porcelain basin, the water turning murky. Now clad in a thin white cotton chemise, she sat rigidly on the edge of the bed. She didn't trust him. Men like Desmond, men with titles and wealth and deep gravelly voices, did not simply forgive debts and leave their young brides alone on their wedding night. Her father had warned her. "He'll expect obedience, Margot. He's paying enough for it." She stared at the heavy oak door. There was no lock. The clock on the mantel ticked. It was a loud, rhythmic sound that seemed to amplify her racing heartbeat. 1 in the morning, 1:30. At 1:45, the heavy thud of boots sounded in the hallway. Margot stiffened. She grabbed the edge of the mattress, her knuckles turning white. Her breathing grew shallow. The footsteps stopped outside her door. A pause. Then a single sharp knock. Before she could speak, the handle turned. Desmond stepped into the room. He had shed his formal coat and waistcoat. He wore dark trousers and a simple, slightly wrinkled white linen shirt, the sleeves rolled up to his forearms. He was carrying a wooden tray. He took one step into the room and stopped. Margot was sitting on the bed, her legs pulled tight to her chest, her eyes wide and dark with pure, unfiltered terror. She looked like a trapped animal waiting for the axe to fall. Desmond's jaw tightened. A muscle jumped in his cheek. He looked at her, then looked away, staring into the fireplace. "Put a dressing gown on," he said, his voice flat.
You'll freeze.
Margot didn't move. She couldn't. Desmond let out a slow, heavy breath through his nose. He set the tray down on a small table near the fire. He didn't approach the bed. He didn't even look at her again.
You didn't eat at the reception, he said to the wall.
And what you drank, you left on the north road. If you try to sleep on an empty stomach, you'll wake up sick.
He turned and walked toward the door.
Eat. Go to sleep. He closed the door behind him with a soft click. Margot sat frozen for a long time. The ticking of the clock was the only sound. Slowly, cautiously, she unfolded her legs. She padded barefoot across the cold floorboards toward the small table. On the tray was a thick slab of cold roasted mutton, half a loaf of dark, crusty bread, a small pot of sharp yellow mustard, and a hunk of hard cheese. Beside it sat a heavy glass of dark ale. It wasn't delicate food. It wasn't wedding cake.
Margot looked at the door. Then she looked at the bread. Her stomach gave a violent, hollow cramp. She abandoned all decorum. She tore a piece of the bread off with her bare hands, dunked it into the mustard, and shoved it into her mouth. The sharpness of the mustard and the dense, earthy flavor of the rye hit her tongue like an electric shock. She sat on the rug in front of the fire, her knees pulled up beneath her thin chemise, and ate with feral intensity. She tore the mutton apart with her teeth. She drank the ale in deep, unladylike gulps. It tasted of roasted barley and earth. It was the best meal she had ever had in her life. When the tray was entirely empty, she sat back, wiping her mouth with the back of her hand. Her body felt heavy, warm, and grounded. The terror that had gripped her spine was gone, replaced by a strange, heavy lethargy. She crawled into the massive bed, pulling the heavy wool blankets up to her chin. For the first time in months since the creditors had started knocking, Margot closed her eyes and immediately fell into a deep, dreamless sleep. She woke to the sound of metal ringing against metal. Margot blinked, staring up at the unfamiliar dark wood canopy above her. It took her a moment to remember the altar, the carriage, the mud, the mutton. She sat up. The fire had died down to white ash. The room was freezing. She dressed quickly in a plain woolen day dress, shivering as she fumbled with the buttons. She walked to the window and pushed aside the heavy drapes. High Cross Estate in the daylight was just as unforgiving as it had been in the dark. The sky was a low, uniform gray, threatening rain. Below her window was a large cobblestone courtyard, surrounded by stables and barns. There, in the center of the yard, was her husband. Desmond was standing by a massive, restless black draft horse. He wore a heavy leather apron over a rough canvas shirt. He was arguing with a smaller man who wore a farrier's apron. Margot cracked the window open slightly. The bite of the cold air rushed in, carrying the scent of wood smoke, wet earth, and horse sweat.
"I told you yesterday, Miller, the angle is too steep."
Desmond's deep voice carried easily across the yard. He didn't sound angry, just intensely frustrated.
"The shoe fits your grace. It's the hoof that's odd,"
the farrier protested. Desmond sighed a massive expansion of his chest. He bent down, running a large hand down the horse's thick leg, unfazed as the massive animal shifted its weight. He lifted the hoof himself, cradling it between his knees.
"Look here." Desmond pointed to the rim of the hoof.
"He's compensating. If you nail it here, he'll be lame by Tuesday. Rasp it down on the outside." He dropped the hoof and gave the horse a firm pat on the flank. "Do it again." Margot watched from the window completely still. In London, lords did not argue with farriers about hoof angles. They did not wear leather aprons. They did not have dirt under their fingernails. They sat in clubs, drank port, and ruined their families with bad investments. Her father had sold her to a monster or so, she had thought. But watching Desmond wipe a smear of grease off his forehead with the back of his wrist, Margot felt a profound, unsettling shift in her chest. He wasn't a monster. He wasn't a gentleman, either. He was simply a man trying to keep an estate from falling apart. She closed the window quietly, the cold glass biting into her fingertips. The anger that had fueled her for weeks, the fiery resentment she had clung to like a shield, suddenly felt very heavy and entirely useless. For the first 4 days at High Cross, Margot existed as a ghost haunting her own life. She took her meals alone in the cavernous dining room. A single place setting of slightly tarnished silver sat at the end of a table built to seat 30. Mrs. Hughes served her thick soups, heavy stews, and root vegetables. It was fuel, not fine dining. Desmond was nowhere to be seen. He left the house before dawn and returned long after she had retreated to the blue room. The silence of the house was a physical weight. It pressed against her eardrums. In London, there had always been noise carriages rattling street vendors, shouting her father loudly, bargaining with men who held his promissory notes. Here, there was only the wind battering the thick stone walls and the occasional distant bark of the hounds. By the fifth day, the boredom metastasized into a restless, crawling anxiety. Margot could not simply sit by the fire and embroider. She didn't know how to embroider for one thing. Her father had fired the governess when she was 14. Since then, her education had consisted entirely of avoiding creditors and managing household accounts on a shoestring budget. She left the blue room. The corridors were cold, smelling of beeswax and ancient dust. She walked without a destination, pushing open heavy oak doors. Most rooms were shrouded in linen dust covers, looking like graveyards of forgotten furniture. Then she found the study. It was located at the end of the west wing. The door was ajar. Margot slipped inside. The room smelled intensely of Desmond woodsmoke leather and a sharp metallic hint of ink. It was chaotic. The desk, a massive block of scarred mahogany, was buried under precarious stacks of parchment-bound ledgers and rolled maps. Margot approached the desk. She knew she shouldn't. She was intruding. But the sight of an open ledger drew her in like a magnet. Numbers made sense. Numbers didn't lie, abandon you, or sell you to a stranger. She leaned over the desk. The handwriting was aggressive, slanted heavily to the right. It was a tally of the autumn grain harvest weighed against the cost of winter feed for the sheep. Margot frowned. She dragged her index finger down the column. She did the math in her head, a survival skill honed over years of checking her father's optimistic, fraudulent accounting. She reached the bottom of the page. The total was wrong. Not by a few shillings. By 80 pounds. A devastating error for an estate that, judging by the fraying rugs and drafty halls, was not overflowing with liquid gold. Looking for a way out, Margot jumped her elbow, clipping a stack of letters. They cascaded to the floor with a dry rustle. Desmond stood in the doorway. He was wearing his heavy riding coat, his boots caked in fresh, wet earth. His dark hair was plastered to his forehead with rain. He looked massive in the doorframe, a dark silhouette against the dim hallway. "I was exploring," Margot said. Her voice wavered, but she forced her chin up. "The house is a tomb." Desmond stepped into the room, closing the door behind him. The click of the latch sounded obscenely loud. He walked around the desk, his heavy boots thudding against the floorboards. He didn't look angry. He just looked tired. He knelt, picking up the scattered letters. "It is a working estate, Margot, not a social club. The staff has chores. I have duties." "And what are my duties?" She snapped the frustration of the past 5 days boiling over. "Sitting in a room, staring at a fire, eating mutton until I turn into a sheep." Desmond paused, a letter half raised in his hand. He looked up at her. His eyes, usually a flat, unreadable dark brown, flickered with a strange amusement. "You can do whatever you please," he said, rising to his feet and dropping the letters onto the desk. "Read in the library. Ride the horses. Redecorate the drawing room, though I doubt there's much budget for it." Margot looked down at the open ledger. Then she looked back at him. "You're short 80 pounds, she said. Desmond stopped. "What? Here." Margot jabbed her finger at the bottom of the page. She didn't care that she was crossing a line. The numbers were wrong, and it irked her. "You calculated the oats at last year's market price, but you wrote the current year's yield. The price dropped 2 pence a bushel in September. Your total is 80 pounds heavier than it should be." Desmond stared at her. He stepped closer, leaning over her shoulder to look at the page. He was so close she could feel the damp cold radiating from his wool coat. He smelled of rain and horse sweat. He traced the column with a thick, calloused finger. He muttered a sharp, very ungentlemanly curse under his breath. "Who taught you to read a ledger?" he asked, his voice low. "My father," Margot said bitterly. "He was brilliant at spending money and terrible at tracking it. Someone had to know exactly how ruined we were." Desmond stood up straight. He looked at her, really looked at her for a long, silent minute. The dismissive weariness was gone from his expression. He reached across the desk, picked up a steel-nibbed pen, dipped it in the inkwell, and held it out to her. "Fix it," he said. Margot hesitated. She looked at the pen, then at his rough, scarred hand, offering it. She took it. The wood was warm from his grip. She crossed out his aggressive slanted numbers and wrote the correct total in her own small, sharp script. When she finished, she set the pen down. "Thank you," Desmond said quietly. He didn't offer a compliment. He didn't patronize her. He stated a fact. It was the first time in her life a man had thanked her for being smart instead of pretty. The realization settled in her chest, heavy and deeply confusing. Winter hit the northern counties not with a snowfall, but with an assault. The temperature plummeted overnight. Freezing rain turned the courtyards into sheets of gray ice. The wind howled through the chimneys of High Cross, a high shrieking sound that rattled the window panes. By noon, the estate was in crisis. A section of the lower sheepfold roof had collapsed under the weight of accumulated ice pinning half a dozen ewes. Margot watched from the kitchen window. The yard was a blur of frantic movement. Men wrapped in thick wool were hacking at the ice with iron bars. Desmond was in the center of it all, knee-deep in freezing mud and splintered wood, his shoulder braced against a sagging crossbeam while two farmhands pulled terrified sheep from the wreckage. Inside the kitchen, the heat was stifling. Mrs. Hughes and a young maid named Clara were frantically boiling water, preparing thick stews, and tearing old linens into strips for the injured animals. Margot stood by the window feeling entirely useless. Her silk dresses hung in the wardrobe upstairs, artifacts of a different universe. She turned away from the glass. She walked to the large wooden work table, picked up a paring knife, and grabbed a massive dirt-crusted turnip from a burlap sack. Mrs. Hughes paused a heavy iron pot in her hands. "Your Grace, you shouldn't... If I have to stand here and watch him hold up a roof with his bare hands, I'm going to lose my mind," Margot interrupted, her voice tight. "Show me how to peel this without taking my thumb off."
For the next 4 hours, Margot peeled. Turnips, potatoes, carrots. Her hands soft and uncalloused, quickly blistered. The knife slipped twice, nicking her knuckles. She ignored the stinging. The kitchen smelled of wet wool boiling onions and sharp earth. It was chaotic loud, and for the first time since she arrived, she felt like she existed. The heavy kitchen door smashed open. The wind shrieked into the room, bringing a flurry of sleet. Desmond stood in the doorway. He was a terrifying sight. His face was gray with exhaustion, his lips a pale, bruised purple. His heavy coat was soaked through freezing into a stiff armor of ice. He leaned heavily against the stone doorframe, his chest heaving. The hounds pushed past his legs, shaking freezing water all over the stone floor. "Roof is short up," he rasped. His voice was completely ruined, stripped to a hoarse whisper. "Lost two ewes. The rest are safe." He stepped into the kitchen, reaching up to unfasten his coat. His fingers were stiff blue with cold. He fumbled blindly with the large horn buttons. Margot dropped her knife. She crossed the kitchen in 5 quick strides. She didn't ask permission. She swatted his clumsy hands away and grabbed the edges of his coat. "Stop," she ordered. Desmond froze, looking down at her in shock. Margot's fingers were small, but they were nimble. She worked the stiff buttons free, pulling the heavy soaking wool off his shoulders. Underneath, his linen shirt was plastered to his skin, wet with sweat and melted ice. As she pulled the sleeve down his right arm, Desmond hissed a sharp intake of breath through his teeth. Margot stopped. She looked at his forearm. The shirt was torn. A jagged gash ran from his elbow to his wrist, sliced open by a splintered beam. It was a vicious wound, sluggishly seeping dark crimson into the wet fabric. "Sit down," Margot said.
Her voice didn't shake. The panic was there, a cold knot in her throat, but she shoved it down. Desmond looked at the wooden chair by the hearth, then back at her. "It's just a scratch. I need to check the horses. Some poke." "You're freezing, you're dripping on Mrs. Hughes's floor, and you are bleeding on your own shirt." Margot snapped, surprising herself with the sheer volume of her voice. "Sit down." Desmond blinked. Then slowly he limped to the chair and sat. Margot turned to the housekeeper. "Mrs. Hughes, hot water, carbolic soap, and clean linen." She knelt on the stone floor beside his chair. She rolled his wet sleeve up past his elbow, careful not to drag the fabric over the open wound. His arm was massive, roped with thick muscle, and icy to the touch. Mrs. Hughes placed a steaming basin on the floor. Margot took a rag, dipped it in the hot water, and wrung it out. "This is gonna hurt," she warned, not looking up at his face. "I've had worse," he muttered. She pressed the hot, soapy rag into the gash. Desmond's entire body went rigid. His massive hand gripped the edge of the wooden chair, his knuckles turning stark white. He didn't make a sound, but she felt the violent tremor running through his leg mere inches from her shoulder. She worked quickly, scrubbing the dirt and wood fragments out of the raw skin. It was ugly, intimate work. The smell of the harsh carbolic soap burned her nose. Her own hands were shaking slick with water and the residue of his injury. When the wound was clean, she wrapped it tightly in strips of dry linen, pulling the bandages taut to stop the weeping. She tied off the end of the bandage and sat back on her heels. She was breathing hard. A strand of hair had escaped her pins, clinging to her damp forehead. Her simple day dress was ruined, soaked at the knees, and stained with dirt. Desmond was looking at her. He wasn't looking at his arm. He was looking at her face. His dark eyes intense and entirely unreadable, the exhaustion in his face had shifted into something sharper. "You didn't faint," he said quietly. "I threw up in a ditch on my wedding night," Margot replied, wiping the back of her hand across her forehead. "I think we've established I lack the delicate sensibilities of a proper duchess." A corner of Desmond's mouth twitched. It wasn't quite a smile, but it was close. The rigid tension in his jaw softened. "Thank you, Margot." It was the second time he had thanked her. The sound of her name in his deep, gravelly voice sent a sudden, shocking jolt of warmth straight down her spine, entirely independent of the fire burning in the hearth. The storm raged for 3 days, sealing Highcross off from the rest of the world. By the evening of the third day, a strange, fragile truce had settled over the estate. The immediate danger to the livestock had passed. The house was locked tight against the howling wind. Margot found herself in the study again. Desmond was sitting behind his desk. He looked slightly better. The gray pallor was gone, replaced by a ruddy burn from the wind. His right arm was stiff in its bandage, resting on the armrest of his chair. He was pouring a drink. He filled two thick crystal tumblers with amber liquid. He pushed one across the mahogany desk. Margot sat in the leather wingback chair opposite him. She looked at the glass. "Whiskey?" she asked. "Is it proper for a wife to drink whiskey in her husband's study?" "Nothing about this marriage is proper, Margot," Desmond said bluntly. He picked up his glass. "We might as well be honest about it." He drank. Margot picked up her glass and took a small sip. The liquid burned a fiery trail down her throat, settling as a heavy warmth in her stomach. She looked at him. The firelight cast deep shadows in the hollows of his face, emphasizing the gray in his hair. He looked every bit his 42 years. He looked like a man who carried the weight of the sky on his shoulders. "The estate is struggling," she said. It wasn't a question. Desmond didn't flinch. He set his glass down. "Yes. The soil in the north is poor. The winters are long. My father neglected the tenant farms for 20 years. I've spent the last decade trying to pull Highcross out of the mud." Margot frowned, her fingers tracing the rim of her glass. "Then why did you pay my father's debts?" "It was a fortune, Desmond. You handed over a fortune you needed here. For what an heir." Desmond leaned back in his chair. He stared into the fire, the flames reflecting in his dark eyes. The silence stretched thick and heavy, punctuated only by the wind rattling the glass panes.
"I needed a wife," he said slowly, his voice dropping to a low rumble.
"The line requires an heir, yes, but more than that, I needed someone who wouldn't break." He turned his head to look at her. The intensity of his gaze pinned her to the leather chair.
"I saw you in London," he said. Margot froze.
"You came to my father's study. I wasn't there."
"Not then," Desmond corrected. 2 days prior, I was leaving my solicitor's office in Mayfair. I saw a carriage pull up to your townhouse. 2 men got out. Bailiffs. They were angry."
Margot swallowed hard. The memory tasted like ash. She remembered that day. Her father had locked himself in the cellar with a bottle of gin.
"I watched you open the door."
Desmond continued, his voice softening, taking on a strange, rough reverence.
"You couldn't have been more than 100 pounds soaking wet. You were wearing a dress that had been mended at the hem, and you stood on that top step with a heavy brass fireplace poker in your hand, and you told 2 grown men that if they crossed the threshold, you would break their knees."
Margot felt a hot flush of embarrassment crawl up her neck.
"I was terrified. They were going to take the furniture."
"You were terrified," Desmond agreed. "But you didn't back down. You stood your ground. You protected a house that was already falling down around you and a father who didn't deserve your protection." He leaned forward, resting his uninjured arm on the desk. The distance between them suddenly felt dangerously small.
"I don't need a delicate flower, Margot," he said, his voice dropping to a rough whisper. "I don't need a woman who faints at the sight of mud or cries over canceled balls. Highcross would eat a woman like that alive."
He looked at her hands resting on the arm of her chair. They were no longer the soft hands of a London lady. The knuckles were nicked, the thumbs rough from peeling root vegetables, a faint yellow stain of iodine on her wrist from cleaning his wound.
"I bought your father's debts," Desmond said, holding her gaze, "because I wanted the woman with the fireplace poker."
The air in the study vanished. Margot couldn't breathe. The anger she had clung to, the bitter, safe resentment of being treated like property fractured. It shattered completely. He hadn't bought her because she was young and submissive. He had bought her because she was fierce, because he recognized a fellow survivor. She looked at him, her chest rising and falling rapidly. The whiskey was buzzing in her veins, making her reckless.
"You took a terrible risk, Your Grace," she whispered, her voice shaking slightly.
"The woman with the poker is deeply unpleasant." Desmond's mouth curved into a slow, devastating, actual smile. It changed his entire face, erasing 10 years of hard weather.
"I'll take my chances," he murmured.
He reached across the desk. It wasn't a sudden movement. It was slow, deliberate, giving her every opportunity to pull away. He placed his large, rough hand over hers. Margot's breath hitched. His palm was warm, his calluses scraping slightly against her skin. It was the first time he had touched her since he slid the ring onto her finger. But this wasn't a transaction. It wasn't an obligation. It was a connection. She didn't pull away. Slowly, hesitantly, she turned her hand over, tangling her small fingers with his. The wind screamed outside the thick stone walls, but inside the study, sitting across from a man 20 years her senior, Margot felt the first terrifying, undeniable spark of something she had never expected to find in this marriage. Safety. Spring did not arrive at Highcross with delicate blossoms and gentle breezes. It came violently, a brutal thawing that turned the frozen earth into a vast, sucking ocean of gray mud. The air smelled perpetually of wet roots and manure. The skies remained a bruised, sullen purple. Yet inside the damp stone walls, a slow, microscopic shift had occurred. The crushing silence of Margot's first weeks had dissolved into a quiet, functional rhythm. She no longer ate alone in the cavernous dining hall. She ate in the study with Desmond. They shared plates of cold roast beef and sharp cheddar over open ledgers. They didn't speak of the moment he had taken her hand. They simply existed in the aftershock of it, circling each other with the cautious gravity of two wild animals sharing a small enclosure. He gave her the keys to the lockboxes. She took over the estate's correspondence. It was mid-April when the letter arrived. Desmond was out in the lower pastures inspecting the sheep for foot rot. Margot was at the mahogany desk sorting through the morning post brought up from the village. Most of it was mundane seed catalogs bills from the blacksmith, a note from the magistrate. Then she saw the wax seal. It was sloppy, pressed too hard into a thick puddle of crimson wax. The crest was a stag, her father's crest. Margot stared at the thick parchment. A cold, oily sensation coiled in her stomach. Her father had not written a single word to her since the day he practically shoved her into Desmond's carriage. Her fingers trembled slightly as she broke the seal. The handwriting inside was erratic, the ink blotted, betraying a shaking hand or too much gin. Or both. Margot, I trust Carlyle is keeping you well. A sudden, entirely unforeseen embarrassment has arisen regarding the shipping lines. I require £500 by the end of the month to prevent a scandal that would surely stain your new title. Carlyle can easily spare it. Have it drafted to my man in London. Do not fail me in this. Thomas. Margot stopped breathing. The study, previously warm from the hearth, suddenly felt like a meat locker. £500. It was a staggering sum. It was the cost of a new roof for the tenant farmers. It was the winter feed for the entire county. She read the letter again. Stain your new title. It was a threat. He was threatening to drag Desmond's name through the London mud if he didn't get his extortion money. The sanctuary she had built over the last 3 months shattered. She wasn't a partner here. She was a leaking hull. Desmond had bought her to stop the bleeding, and now her father was tearing the stitches open. She could already picture Desmond's face, the weary resignation, the silent realization that he had made a terrible investment. She couldn't let him see it. She couldn't watch the respect in his dark eyes curdle into regret. Margot shoved the letter into the pocket of her wool skirt. She walked upstairs to the blue room and pulled a small wooden box from the bottom of her trunk. Inside lay a velvet pouch holding a heavy sapphire and diamond brooch. It had belonged to her mother. Her father had tried to pawn it 3 times, but Margot had hidden it in the lining of her winter coat. It was easily worth £600. Sutton, the nearest market town with a jeweler capable of handling such a piece, was 7 miles away. The carriage was in the barn, missing a wheel. Desmond had taken his black draft horse. Margot didn't hesitate. She went down to the stables, the mud sucking at the hems of her boots. The stable boy was mucking out the far stalls. Only one horse was saddled, a gray gelding Desmond sometimes used for light work. She didn't know how to ride properly. She had sat on a docile mare in Hyde Park 2 times when she was 16, but desperation is a phenomenal instructor. She hauled herself up into the heavy leather saddle, ignoring the sharp protest of her wool skirt, and kicked the gelding into a rough, jarring trot toward the main road. The sky broke open 2 miles down the Sutton Road. It wasn't a shower. It was a deluge. Sheets of freezing rain lashed against Margot's face, instantly soaking through her cloak. The dirt road, already soft from the thaw, turned into a treacherous trench of slick clay. The gelding hated it. He pinned his ears back, tossing his head violently against the bit. Margot's hands, numb and ungloved, gripped the slick leather reins until her knuckles ached. The wind tore the pins from her hair, whipping wet strands across her eyes. Steady? She gasped, her voice swallowed by the roaring wind. She was freezing. Her teeth chattered so violently, her jaw ached. But she kept kicking the horse forward. She had to sell the brooch. She had to send the draft to London. She had to fix the rot she had brought into Desmond's house before he smelled the decay. They hit a deep rut hidden beneath a puddle of brown water. The gelding stumbled. His front knees buckled into the mud. He panicked, throwing his weight back and rearing with a high panicked whinny. Margot had no balance, no stirrups to brace against. She flew over the horse's left shoulder. She hit the ground hard. The impact punched the air from her lungs in a sickening rush. She rolled into the freezing mud, her shoulder taking the brunt of the fall. The gelding scrambled upright, his hooves sliding dangerously close to her head, and bolted back toward High Cross. Margot lay in the ditch. The rain beat down on her heavy as lead shot. She tried to suck in a breath, but her chest seized. Pain radiated from her left collarbone, sharp and bright. She pushed herself up onto her elbows. She was covered chest to knee in thick, foul-smelling gray mud. The pouch with the brooch was still in her pocket, pressing heavily against her hip. She sat up, shivering uncontrollably. She was 5 miles from Sutton, 2 miles from High Cross, and entirely alone in a blinding storm. She didn't cry. Crying was for London parlors. Instead, she let out a raw, guttural scream of pure frustration, slamming her fist into the mud. It took her 20 minutes to drag herself to her feet. Every step sent a jolt of nausea up her throat. She began to walk back the way she came. She would walk to Sutton. She would walk to London if she had to. A sound cut through the rain, the heavy, rhythmic thunder of massive hooves splashing through deep mud. A black shape materialized from the gray downpour. Desmond. He was riding bareback on the massive draft horse, wearing no coat, his linen shirt plastered transparent against his chest. His hair was plastered to his skull. He saw her limping on the side of the road and hauled back on the reins so violently the massive horse slid 3 feet in the mud. Desmond threw himself off the horse before it had even stopped moving. He closed the distance between them in seconds. He didn't look relieved. He looked murderous. "What in God's name are you doing?" he roared over the rain. He grabbed her by the shoulders. His massive hands were trembling. The gelding came back riderless. "Do you know what I thought? Do you have any idea what went through my head?" "Let go of me," Margot shouted back, trying to twist away. The movement sent a white-hot spike of agony through her collarbone, and she gasped, her knees buckling. Desmond caught her instantly. The anger vanished from his face, replaced by a stark, terrifying panic. He scooped her up into his arms, completely ignoring the thick layer of mud covering her. "You're hurt." "Where?" His voice was rough, tight with fear. "I'm fine. Put me down." She choked out, fighting him. It was a pathetic struggle. He held her against his chest, effortlessly. "I have to get to Sutton." "You're not going anywhere but a hot bath, Margot." "No." She slammed her good hand against his chest. Tears of pain and sheer, desperate exhaustion finally mixed with the rain on her face. "You don't understand. He wants money. My father. He wrote to me. He wants £500 or he'll ruin you." Desmond froze. He stood in the pouring rain holding his freezing, mud-soaked wife. "I have my mother's brooch." Margot sobbed the fight finally draining out of her. Her head fell against his wet shoulder. She was so tired. "I was going to sell it. I was going to pay him. I didn't want you to know. I didn't want you to look at me and realize you bought a leaky ship." Desmond stared down at her. The muscle in his jaw jumped furiously. "You foolish, stubborn, magnificent girl," he breathed. He didn't say another word. He shifted her weight, holding her with one arm while he grabbed the draft horse's reins with the other. He hauled himself up onto the horse's broad back, pulling her up and settling her across his lap, tucking her against the heat of his massive chest. He wrapped his arms around her, shielding her from the driving rain, and turned the horse toward home. They didn't go to the Blue Room. Desmond carried her straight past the drafty halls and kicked the door to his own bedroom open. A fire was roaring in the massive hearth. He set her down gently on the rug in front of the flames. She was shivering so violently she couldn't stand on her own. "My collarbone," she gasped as he reached for the muddy buttons of her cloak. "I won't pull it," he promised. His voice was a low rumble, steady and grounding. He worked with clinical efficiency. He stripped the ruined, muddy cloak from her shoulders. He unbuttoned the soaked wool dress, his large fingers deft and careful. He wasn't gentle. Gentleness belonged to men who didn't know how to handle broken things. He was precise. When she was down to her chemise, wet and clinging to her skin, he grabbed a heavy wool blanket from his bed and wrapped it around her shoulders. Margot sat by the fire, her teeth clicking together. Desmond knelt beside her. He was still soaking wet, his shirt clinging to the heavy, scarred musculature of his chest and shoulders. He didn't seem to notice the cold. He reached into the pocket of her discarded muddy dress and pulled out the crumpled, water-stained letter from her father. He opened it. He read it in silence. Margot watched him, her heart pounding a frantic rhythm against her ribs. This was it. The ledger was open. The debt was laid bare. Desmond didn't sigh. He didn't look weary. He calmly folded the letter, reached out, and tossed it directly into the roaring fire. "What are you doing?" Margot croaked, watching the parchment curl and blacken in the flames. "Ending the transaction," Desmond said flatly. He turned back to her. The firelight cast flickering shadows across his hard face. He looked older than his 42 years in that moment, weathered and battered by a lifetime of carrying heavy burdens. "Listen to me, Margot," he said, his voice dropping to a gravelly register that vibrated in her chest. "I did not buy collateral. I did not take a lease on your father's debts. I bought you." He reached out his warm, calloused hand, gripping her uninjured shoulder. "He will not see a single shilling from Highcross. He will rot in debtor's prison before I give him the satisfaction of bleeding my wife dry." Margot stared at him, her chest heaving. "He'll cause a scandal. He'll ruin your name." Desmond let out a sharp, humorless laugh. "Let him. Do you think I care what Mayfair whispers about over their tea? Look around you, Margot. This is my world. Mud, sheep, and stone. The only opinion I give a damn about is the woman sitting in front of me." The absolute certainty in his eyes shattered the last hardened shell of her cynicism. The resentment, the shame, the bitter belief that she was nothing more than a purchased commodity, it all evaporated in the heat of the fire. She looked at his face, at the deep lines bracketing his mouth, the silver in his dark hair, the raw, unfiltered hunger in his eyes. He wasn't a savior. He was a man deeply flawed, aggressively protective, and entirely hers. Margot let the wool blanket slip from her shoulders. She reached out with her good arm, her hand flattening against his wet chest. His heart thundered against her palm, as erratic and frantic as her own. Desmond stopped breathing. He looked down at her hand, then up at her face. The air between them suddenly felt dense, heavy, with a tension that had been building since the moment he put a ring on her oversized knuckle. "Ah, Margot," he rasped a warning deep in his throat. "Don't. Not if it's gratitude. I don't want your gratitude." "It's not gratitude," she said, her voice fierce, dropping her gaze to his mouth. "It's ownership. You bought me. Now I'm claiming you." Desmond groaned a raw, primal sound torn from the back of his throat. He moved forward, closing the space between them. His hands framed her face, rough and desperate. He kissed her. It wasn't polite. It wasn't a gentleman's kiss. It was a collision. He tasted of rain whiskey, an absolute desperation. Margot gasped against his mouth, her fingers tangling in his wet hair. She didn't break. She pushed back, matching his intensity, her mouth opening to him. He kissed her jaw, his heavy stubble scraping against her soft skin. He kissed the curve of her neck, inhaling the scent of rain and carbolic soap that clung to her. He was intensely careful of her bruised shoulder, supporting her weight entirely with his massive frame. He stood up, lifting her with him effortlessly. He carried her to the massive four-poster bed. The sheets were cold-smelling of cedar and his skin. He followed her down. There was no hesitation left. The awkwardness of their age gap, the transactional shadow of their wedding day, it was all burned away. His hands, rough and calloused from the plow, and the reins mapped the topography of her body with a reverence that made her ache. When he finally took her, it was with a deep shuddering groan burying his face in the crook of her neck. Margot cried out, not in pain, but from the overwhelming, terrifying weight of finally being tethered to something solid. She wrapped her good arm tightly around his broad back, holding him as the storm raged outside, anchoring the man who had bought her life and in return had given her his soul. Late August brought a golden, suffocating heat to the northern counties. The air was thick with the smell of dry wheat, pulverized dirt, and the heavy sweetness of ripening apples in the lower orchard. The harvest was in full swing, a frantic dawn-to-dusk battle against the turning season. The study windows were thrown wide open to catch whatever meager breeze managed to crest the hills. Margot sat at the mahogany desk. She wore a simple cotton dress, the sleeves rolled up past her elbows. The corset had been abandoned months ago. There was no longer any need for it, nor would it fit. Her stomach was heavily rounded, resting comfortably against the edge of the desk. She was 6 months pregnant. It hadn't been a delicate, swooning revelation. She had simply vomited behind the stables one morning in May, wiped her mouth, and told Desmond over breakfast that they needed to convert the dressing room into a nursery. He had dropped a full cup of hot coffee onto the stone floor and stared at her for a full minute before pulling her out of her chair and burying his face in her stomach. She dipped her steel pen into the inkwell. She was reviewing the final tally of the barley crop. The numbers were beautiful. For the first time in 12 years, High Cross was operating at a surplus. The new roof on the tenant farms had held. The sheep had yielded a heavy fleece. The ledgers were balanced not with aggressive slanted red ink, but with precise, sharp black lines. Heavy boots thudded on the wooden floorboards of the hallway. The door opened. Desmond walked in. He was filthy. His linen shirt was unbuttoned halfway down his chest, plastered to his skin with sweat and chaff. His face and forearms were coated in a fine layer of golden dust. He looked exhausted, brutalized by the sun, and utterly triumphant. He didn't say a word. He walked behind the desk, leaned down, and pressed his mouth to the top of her head. He smelled intensely of the field, sun-baked earth, dried grass, and honest labor. Margot leaned back against him, closing her eyes, as his large, calloused hands rested gently on her swollen stomach. "The north field is cleared." His low, gravelly voice rumbled against her hair. "We beat the rain." "I know," Margot said, opening her eyes and pointing to the ledger with the tip of her pen. "I've already cataloged the yield. We're up 14% from last year." Desmond chuckled a deep vibration in his chest. He moved around to the side of the desk and hitched one hip onto the corner, looking down at the open book. "You're a ruthless accountant, Margot." He murmured, his dark eyes crinkling at the corners. "Someone has to be," she replied lightly, setting the pen down. "I can't have my husband bankrupting us on expensive new plows just because he likes the ironwork." He reached out his rough thumb, tracing the ink smudge on the side of her hand. "Did you write to the architect about the nursery windows?" "Yesterday. He says they can be widened by October." Margot looked up at him. The gray at his temples had spread slightly over the summer, the lines around his mouth carved a fraction deeper by the sun. He was a hard man, a difficult man. But looking at him now, Margot felt no fear, no resentment, only a deep, profound anchoring. "My father wrote again," she said quietly. Desmond's thumb paused on her skin. The relaxed posture vanished his broad shoulders, stiffening instantly. "Did he?" "Yes." Margot reached into the drawer, pulled out a letter with a broken stag seal, and handed it to him. "He claims he is in desperate health and requires a sea voyage to recover his constitution. He needs 200 pounds. Desmond looked at the letter, his jaw tightening into a hard, unforgiving line. He looked at Margot. "What do you want me to do?" he asked. It was a genuine question. 6 months ago, he would have thrown it in the fire without asking. Now he deferred to her. She was not his ward. She was his wife. Margot looked at the man who had bought her debts. She thought of the cold carriage ride, the vomiting in the ditch, the carbolic soap, the mud, the fire, and the sheer, staggering weight of his kindness. She took the letter back from his hand. She tore it neatly in half. Then she tore it again, dropping the pieces into the empty metal waste bin beside the desk. "Nothing," Margot said, her voice steady and clear. "We owe him nothing. The debt is paid." Desmond stared at her for a long moment. Then that slow, devastating smile spread across his face. He reached down, hooking his hands under her arms, and hauled her up from the chair. He ignored her indignant squawk, wrapping his arms around her waist and pulling her flush against his dusty, sweat-soaked chest. You're getting dirt on the ledgers, she complained, wrapping her arms around his thick neck anyway.
The ledgers can wait, he murmured, his mouth hovering inches from hers.
You've balanced the books, Duchess. Now kiss your husband.
Margot smiled a genuine, imperfect curve of her lips. She pulled him down, closing the distance, sealing the transaction with the only currency that mattered.
And so the ledger closes not on a transaction, but on a partnership forged in the harshest of winters. Margot and Desmond didn't find a delicate fairy tale. They found something far better. They found reality grit and a fierce loyalty built on mutual survival. Sometimes the most enduring romances don't start with poetry or grand declarations. They start with a heavy wool blanket, shared silence, and the courage to stay when the storm hits. If their journey moved, you please hit that like button and share this video with someone who appreciates a grounded, slow burn romance. Don't forget to subscribe to the channel so you never miss our upcoming historical stories. Until next time, thank you for listening.